Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, January 13th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Officials Work on Mass Vaccine Distribution Plan for Midland, by Stuart Doreen. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers stated Tuesday there are around 18,000 people in Midland County over the age of 65. Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health, stated there are currently around 4,000 people that have called the Midland Health Department to get on the list to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. So, they believe the need for a vaccine is there, and on Tuesday they described plans in place to ask the state for up to 10,000 COVID vaccine doses. Myers said during a news conference, the state is now distributing vaccine in larger quantities to sites that can, in turn, deliver it to more people in a shorter period of time. Myers said most of the distribution up to this point has been in small numbers to pharmacies and health departments that don't have the ability to deliver a lot of doses of the vaccine. It's been a little bit haphazard, he said. Myers said Midland Health will work with the city, county, and other members in the community as it comes up with a comprehensive plan to submit to a state panel that determines where large numbers of vaccines go across the state. That panel next meets on Monday, Myers said. They'll have our plan in front of them, Myers said. We can put a huge dent in that population if we can get a substantial vaccination allocation and delivery of that to a mass vaccine site. Myers said, the nursing home vaccination process is ongoing, led by CVS and Walgreens, officials working toward nursing homes directly. Wilson said Tuesday that the goal of a mass distribution program is to address those that have signed up through the Midland Health Department. He also said the people likely to be vaccinated the earliest will be Tier 1A and Tier 1B persons, the highest priority groups to receive vaccination if there is limited vaccine supply, according to the CDC, including the elderly and those with underlying health conditions. The plan also will focus on vaccines for healthcare workers as well, Myers said. Myers said there is no way to sign up and get on a waiting list for this mass distribution effort yet. He expects there will be one or two sites where officials will be giving the vaccine all day long. He also said the expectation is that reservations will be required. If our plan doesn't include a carefully scheduled registration process, we won't get the allocation, Myers said. We hope to be able to communicate that plan soon. This article is entitled, City Will Provide Hotel Rooms for Homeless Who Contract COVID, by Caitlin Randall. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved allotting $200,000 of its remaining federal CARES Act funding to temporarily house the homeless in hotel rooms if they become infected with COVID-19. The city is hoping the initiative will prevent super spreader events at local homeless shelters, according to community development manager Isaac Garnett. He said during Tuesday's meeting that city officials have received concerned emails from community members related to coronavirus cases at the Salvation Army of Midland. They have families and individuals who test positive, but nowhere to isolate them, Garnett said. The City of Midland will enter into contracts with local hotels and motels to reserve 10 rooms for homeless COVID-19 patients so they are able to quarantine for the required 14 days, according to city planning documents. The hotel room rate will not exceed $150 a night. Any unused funds will be redistributed, and the allocated funding will cover personal protective equipment to clean and sanitize rooms. Other cities and counties nationwide have reserved hotel rooms for their homeless populations throughout the pandemic. Dallas city officials said in March they were reserving 50 hotel rooms to prevent coronavirus outbreaks among the homeless. The Midland City Council also allotted $600,000 in CARES Act funding on Tuesday to assist the Midland Health Department with vaccine distribution. The funds will be used for office equipment, medical supplies, PPE, and vaccine storage, according to city documents. The health department has requested 10 additional positions for contact tracers and case investigators to address vaccination efforts. The health department received 200 doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine on December 29th and began administering those doses last week. More than 4,000 people have signed up for the health department's vaccine waitlist, according to Dr. Larry Wilson, chief medical officer for Midland Health, on Tuesday. City officials said the health department does not yet know when they'll receive another shipment. City council members unanimously approved the vaccine distribution and homeless assistance initiatives. The funds allocated Tuesday came from $1.4 million in CARES funding the city received for a community development block grant. There's a remaining balance of about $640,000 from that grant, according to city documents. This article is entitled, Pioneer Completes $4.5 Billion Acquisition of Parsley, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Pioneer Natural Resources has completed its $4.5 billion acquisition of Parsley Energy, creating a powerhouse in the prolific Permian Basin of West Texas. Shareholders from both companies approved the merger at a special meeting on Tuesday. Parsley stockholders will receive 0.1252 shares of Pioneer stock for each share of Parsley stock owned. After Tuesday, Parsley stock will no longer be traded on the New York Stock Exchange. We are excited to close our transaction with Parsley and begin delivering on the significant synergies provided by this combination, Pioneer CEO Scott Sheffield said in a statement. We appreciate the strong support from shareholders and are confident in the tangible and durable value created through this transaction, forming the premier Permian independent energy company. Consolidation is sweeping the energy sector as the industry pulls out of the oil bust caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Oil and gas companies are joining forces and acquiring assets to better weather such downturns. Recent mergers and acquisitions deals include Chevron's $13.7 billion acquisition of Houston-based Noble Energy in October, Devon Energy's $5.8 billion acquisition of WPX Energy, and Southwestern Energy's $193 million acquisition of Montage Resources in November. Dallas-based Pioneer announced plans to take over rival Parsley in October. The combined company, which will have access to 930,000 acres in the Midland and Delaware basins, is expected to lead to annual savings of more than $325 million by 2021. Pioneer plans to cut costs by combining water resources, refinancing debt, and streamlining operations. Pioneer last month said it plans to cut 100 jobs in Midland after its acquisition with Parsley. The layoffs will occur over 3 months beginning in February at Parsley's headquarters in Midland. Some of the employees will be offered jobs with Pioneer outside of Midland. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, COVID Death Count Hits 200 Inside Midland County, from Staff Reports. The City of Midland reported another 6 Midland County residents died this month because of complications with COVID-19. The city showed the deaths took place from January 6th to 12th and involved 3 women and 3 men. Those passing away included 2 patients in their 50s, 1 in his 70s, 2 in their 80s, and a woman in her 90s. 5 were said to have had underlying conditions, according to the city. All but 1 were being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. The other was being treated at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. The deaths were the 10th through 15th reported this month and brought the total during the pandemic to 200. As of Tuesday afternoon, the Department of State Health Services website showed 29 other Texas counties with 200 or more COVID-related fatalities. The Midland Health Department did report 70 total cases on Monday. That is a decrease from the 198 cases on January 4th. In fact, the Health Department shows 84 cases on Sunday and Monday. That is less than the 289 on January 3rd to the 4th. The total number of cases inside Midland County is up to 14,502. This article is entitled, Lieutenant Governor Patrick Says Enough Blaming Antifa for Capital Attack, by Jeremy Wallace, Houston Chronicle. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is telling his supporters to stop blaming left-wing activists for the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Patrick, one of President Donald Trump's most important allies in Texas, told supporters in a lengthy message over the weekend that the people involved in storming the Capitol were Trump supporters. Some in the conservative world have tried to claim it was left-wing activists who were parading as Trump supporters. There are no excuses for those who stormed the Capitol on Wednesday, Patrick said. Five people died. And sadly, it appears that most of the protesters inside the Capitol were Trump supporters. Patrick said one reason he knows that is Antifa protesters, a decentralized anti-fascism movement, typically cover their faces. Patrick also condemned those involved in the attack. There is no such thing as justifiable political violence, Patrick said. Politics is never an excuse for criminal behavior. Patrick has been a key advisor to Trump's White House on immigration policy and was chairman of Trump's Texas campaigns in both 2016 and 2020. Patrick is not expected to be with Trump on Tuesday in Hidalgo County when the president makes a final stop along the Texas border before his term in office ends on January 20th. But Patrick over the weekend also blasted those on the left who have tried to make it appear all Trump supporters deserve blame for the death and destruction that occurred. Enough of blaming all Trump supporters for the crimes of a small group who attacked the Capitol, Patrick wrote. I've spoken to and met thousands of Trump supporters across the nation. They love this country and the Constitution. They hate what they saw at the U.S. Capitol as much as I do. Patrick also offered a defense of U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who had objected to certifying the presidential election results just moments before the Capitol was stormed. Patrick said Cruz's actions did not incite the crowd.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, January 13, 2021. Serving the community. Staff and volunteers manned the grills inside Tubby's Mobile Kitchen Saturday outside the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center as they prepare breakfast to serve 500 community members as part of Community Worship Center giving back to the community. Meetings. Midland ISD, 5:30 p.m. Midland Country Club. Note, superintendent candidate interview to be held in closed session. When it's open, U.S. Postal Service downtown, 100 East Wall Street, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Village, 2315 West Louisiana Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Graves, 3304 West Watley Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday. Claydesta, 612 Veterans Air Park Lane, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. GMF Midland, 1000 Loop 40, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Midland County Public Libraries, Centennial Branch, 9 to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, 2503 West Loop 250 North, 432-742-7400. Downtown Branch, 9 to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., Saturday, 301 West Missouri Avenue, 432-688-4320. Note, Midland County Public Libraries will be closed Saturday through Monday, January 16 through 18, in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Contact your representative, Midland County, P.O. Box 421, Midland, Texas, 79702. Website, www.co.midland.tx.us. County Judge Terry Johnson, 688-4310. Commissioners, Precinct 1, Scott Ramsey, Precinct 2, Robin Donnelly, Precinct 3, Luis D. Sanchez, Precinct 4, Randy Prude. Large item pickup. For residential customers, the City of Midland will pick up furniture and appliances at no additional charge. These items must be placed in the alley in the city right-of-way. The city will not go onto private property. Do not place your item next to the dumpster. It needs to be behind your home in the alley. These larger item collections must be scheduled with the Solid Waste Division. Please call 685-7278 to schedule the service. City of Midland. Today in history. Today is Wednesday, January 13, the 13th day of 2021. There are 352 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On January 13, 1982, an Air Florida 737 crashed into Washington, D.C.'s 14th Street Bridge and fell into the Potomac River while trying to take off during a snowstorm, killing a total of 78 people, including four motorists on the bridge, four passengers, and a flight attendant survived. On this date, in 1733, James Oglethorpe and some 120 English colonists arrived at Charleston, South Carolina, while en route to settle in present-day Georgia. In 1794, President George Washington approved a measure adding two stars and two stripes to the American flag, following the admission of Vermont and Kentucky to the Union. The number of stripes was later reduced to the original 13. In 1898, Emile Zola's famous defense of Captain Alfred Dreyfus, Jacques, was published in Paris. In 2005, Major League Baseball adopted a tougher steroid testing program that would suspend first-time offenders for 10 days and randomly test players year-round. In 2018, a false alarm that warned of a ballistic missile headed for Hawaii sent the islands into a panic, with people abandoning cars on a highway and preparing to flee their homes. Officials apologized and said the alert was sent when someone hit the wrong button during a shift change. Today's birthdays. Actor Julia Louise Dreyfus is 60. Country singer Trace Adkins is 59. Actor Patrick Dempsey is 55.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "Cruz Miscalculated How to Deal with Donald Trump," by Gromer Jeffers, Jr., Dallas Morning News. Ted Cruz is a successful politician who rose from obscurity to score an upset win for the U.S. Senate. He became one of the best-known constitutional conservatives in the country and set himself up for a 2016 presidential run, even though Democrats and moderate Republicans detested him. But Cruz, Texas's junior senator, has made major miscalculations involving Donald Trump. He underestimated the New York businessman and reality television star as a presidential contender. Then he misread his own popularity with the GOP base by not immediately endorsing the victorious Trump. Afterward, he became too cozy with the president, clearly an effort to inherit Trump's formidable political base. Last week, Trump burned Cruz again. Cruz pushed a controversial proposal to appoint a special commission to examine unfounded allegations of voter fraud in November's elections, a move that fueled the misguided belief among Trump supporters that former Vice President Joe Biden's victory over the incumbent resulted from voter fraud in several battleground states. On January 6th, just before Congress was to certify the 2020 presidential election results, Trump told participants at a Washington rally to march on the Capitol. They did, and a mob stormed the Hill. Rioters entered the Senate chamber searching for Vice President Mike Pence and wreaking havoc. The ordeal resulted in the deaths of five people, including a Capitol police officer. Cruz's last great act for Trump, his rival-turned-ally, backfired. Trump was roundly denounced for rhetoric that many believe incited the riot, and he could face another impeachment trial. Cruz was pilloried for helping push Trump's baseless fraud allegations and trying to obstruct the certification of Biden's victory amid a powder keg of a situation. It's widely speculated that Cruz will run for president in 2024, hoping to build on his 2016 candidacy when he was the Republican runner-up to Trump. He can run for president and seek re-election at the same time, thanks to what's known as the LBJ provision in Texas. Whether he's running for the White House or re-election, the events of last week will make it hard for Cruz to sell himself to a general election audience that includes Democrats, soft Republicans, and independents. Trump has signaled that he'll try to retake the White House in 4 years, which would complicate the candidacies of Cruz and other Republicans. Even if Trump doesn't run, could Cruz still be in a position to seriously challenge for the GOP nomination? It's too early to tell. 4 years seems like an eternity in politics, but at the least, Cruz has to repair the damage done by last week's controversies and rethink his approach to dealing with Trump. Perhaps it's his presidential race loss or the way his supporters turned on him at the convention that's causing Cruz to view being Trump's best bud as a political necessity. What's clear is that the specter of Trump has loomed over Cruz for years. Late in 2015, Cruz trailed Trump in the GOP race for president, but figured he would blow past the bombastic New Yorker when the primary voting started. I wondered why Cruz was flattering Trump instead of trying to pummel the first-time candidate before he ran away from the field. He even invited Trump to join him on the stump. "Look, Donald Trump is not going to get the nomination," Cruz told me in New Hampshire. "Ben Carson is not going to get the nomination." He was wrong about Trump. After Cruz scored an impressive victory in Iowa, Trump staged a ferocious run for the nomination, steamrolling past the large field and reshaping Republican politics. Cruz shifted gears, calling Trump utterly amoral and a pathological liar. For his part, Trump dubbed the senator Lion Ted. "He holds the Bible high and then starts lying," Trump often said. Trump also insulted Cruz's wife Heidi by retweeting an unflattering photo of her. Trump, the candidate, peddled tabloid smut that the Cruz's father, Carrollton, Texas Minister Rafael Cruz, was involved in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. At the GOP convention, and perhaps understandably so, Cruz made another political misstep. During his primetime speech, he told delegates to vote their conscience, and he refused to endorse Trump. Angry delegates booed him off the stage. The next morning, Texas delegates excoriated him at a breakfast event, and he subsequently took a hit in the polls, a trend he managed to reverse before his 2018 re-election bid. Weeks before the general election, and after he released a list of conservative leaders he would consider for the Supreme Court, Cruz gave Trump his backing. What followed was a strong bond between Trump and Cruz. Their families met for dinner, and Cruz rarely criticized the president, telling reporters he wasn't going to respond to every Trump tweet. Trump warmed to Cruz. In 2018, the president held a rally for Cruz in Texas, which curiously occurred before the incumbent senator had a setback in the polls for his re-election bid against former Representative Beto O'Rourke of El Paso. Cruz, summoning the campaign skills that made him a darling of the Tea Party movement, squeaked out a victory over O'Rourke. Since then, Trump has considered the senator for a Supreme Court appointment and tapped Cruz to argue before the High Court a dubious lawsuit to challenge the presidential election results in several battleground states. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton brought that controversial case, which the court refused to hear. Cruz's involvement in Trump's follies didn't stop there, as last week the nation and the world were rocked by the tumult and violence. Conservative columnist George Will accused Cruz of sedition and said he'll bear a scarlet S for the rest of his career. As Cruz moves forward, he should consider that he built his political base before Trump burst on the political scene. Though he's always been a polarizing figure, constitutional and Christian conservatives have powered Cruz's success. He didn't need to take extraordinary steps to woo Trump loyalists to improve his popularity with GOP base voters. Now, He's linked to the president in the worst way, and history won't reflect kindly on his role. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Unity is Still So Difficult to Achieve, by Henry Olson, special to the Washington Post. Many Americans, if not most, want some type of national unity after the horrifying and despicable events of January 6th. But even if that's what a majority of Americans want, accomplishing it will be extraordinarily difficult. Last week's events have exacerbated and intensified our partisan divisions, but they did not cause them. For years, activists on both the right and left have demonized each other as beyond the pale of reasonable discourse. While rarely openly expressed in these terms, this undercurrent has been clear in polls. A Pew Research Center poll from September 2019 shows that across a number of characteristics, nearly three-quarters of both parties said they cannot agree on common facts. Majorities in both parties also say the other side doesn't share non-political values and goals with them. One can only imagine how these numbers look today after the events of the past year and a half. This means that creating unity, if it is possible, must be an active process rather than something Americans passively resort to. Leaders of both parties need to look at their counterparts as adversaries, not enemies, and strive to find common ground rather than default into their respective silos. It's tempting to say that the burden of doing so should be equally shared. The riot last week makes that impossible. Republicans will need to make the first move to build trust so that national unity around common values is possible. At a minimum, that requires acknowledging that the election was free, fair, and reflective of the people's will. That is the plain and simple truth, and Republicans ought to say it clearly, even if they argue there were flaws. GOP leaders had hoped that passive resistance to President Donald Trump's nefarious aims was enough. It was enough to prevent Republican majorities in each of the contested states' legislatures from challenging the results and appointing a competing slate of delegates. It is no longer enough in the present circumstances. Only open acknowledgement that the president and his sycophants lied or deluded themselves about the election will show Democrats and independents that Republicans understand the gravity of what happened. It also requires open acknowledgement that the riot was not the result of Antifa or Black Lives Matter protesters. There might have been some rogue infiltrators, but the overwhelming weight of the evidence is that MAGA believers, not the violent left, stormed the Capitol. Again, there are certainly degrees of culpability even among these people, but it was the Republican side that ransacked our national temple and no one else's. Democrats, however, must restrain their impulse for vengeance. They should accept true repentance with forgiveness. There should be no attempt to use this moment to restrict Republicans' access to the media or to purge Republican voters from any effort to attach substantial policy goals to forgiveness. American democracy, and all liberal democracies, rests on the idea of the loyal opposition. If Republicans can be viewed as loyal only if they do not oppose those in power, genuine democracy has died. The example of Britain during Brexit should be an example to follow. Passions ran deep for nearly 4 years. The country was nearly even divided between Remainers and Leavers, and each side viewed the other as intrinsically wrong-headed about its views. Each side mobilized and fought, and two general elections were waged over the issue. But rarely, if ever, did large numbers of even the most passionate activists question the fundamental patriotism of their opponents. The opposition was intense and bitter, but each viewed the other as loyal. Thus, when the 2019 election clearly established that a Conservative Party committed to Brexit had won, the tumult that had characterized the preceding few years ceased overnight. The people had spoken. The result was legitimate, and normal political debate could resume. We can rebuild the space for normal, intense political dialogue only if we rebuild a platform of shared citizenship upon which those debates can take place. Let us pray that leaders from both parties publicly commit themselves to this goal, and if necessary, face down their intra-party adversaries in its pursuit. If, and when this occurs, only then can we begin to see the light at the end of this very dark tunnel. This column is entitled "Twitter Deranged Our Politics" by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Donald Trump was the president of Twitter. What radio was to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and TV was to Ronald Reagan, communicating 280 characters at a time on a social media platform that is a watchword for hyperactive inanity, was to President Trump. It is symbolically appropriate that the effective end of his power after the siege of the U.S. Capitol has coincided with the suspension of his Twitter account. He may well get impeached a second time, but for now the punishment that really stings is Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey deciding that after sitting down with his woke colleagues, that Trump must pay the ultimate price for his post-election misinformation and agitation. This judgment is as arbitrary as Dorsey's worst critics would expect, and it will be impossible for Twitter to enforce anything resembling a consistent line following its Trump suspension. The platform didn't seem particularly exercised by all of the voices valorizing last summer's riots as an uprising. But there's no doubt of Dorsey's power. He has rendered the President of the United States practically mute. Trump remains in the Oval Office and, in theory, commands the biggest megaphone on the planet. He could still make statements, hold press conferences, sit down for interviews, or meet with his cabinet. In his reduced and isolated state, though, none of these options are as appealing as letting his thumbs do the work for him, one outlandish tweet at a time. Now that this avenue is foreclosed to him, he's less of a presence, even as the political world continues to be obsessed with him, in particular the manner of his exit from office. It's not exactly a slow news environment. Yet without Trump's tweets stirring the pot at all times of the day, the nation's political debate feels a little less fevered. Twitter is Exhibit A for Marshall McLuhan's axiom that the medium is the message. There is plenty of worthy news coverage and real-time commentary on Twitter. But that's not where the emotional center of gravity is, as one would expect of a platform built for instantaneous, unfiltered reactions. It's this aspect of Twitter that perfectly matched the president's proclivities. He found a natural home in an environment that encourages and often rewards snap judgments, insults, soon-to-be-forgotten pronouncements, grotesque oversimplifications, and the spread of false or dubious information. Trump wasn't careful about what he said anywhere, but he reserved his most lurid and poisonous communications for Twitter. It was the place easiest for him to, for instance, absurdly accuse Morning Joe host Joe Scarborough of murder, or insult the looks of his alleged paramour Stormy Daniels. It was a symptom of his erratic, easily distracted, and thoughtless governing style that he used Twitter as a tool of his administration. He warned foreign leaders, fired officials, and made pronouncements on legislation on Twitter, often leaving allies and his own government baffled by what was supposed to be the line between just a tweet and an official order by the President of the United States. Twitter was an especially ready forum for airing conspiracy theories. Asked prior to the election about his giving credence to the lunatic idea that Navy SEAL Team 6 had been assassinated, Trump shrugged and said it was only a retweet. In the wake of his election defeat, his Twitter feed became a nonstop source of bad information dredged up from the worst corners of the internet. If Trump was the foremost offender, Twitter hasn't done us any favors in the period of our national life. It has fed moral panics and enabled cancellation mobs. It has exposed journalists who once made a pretense of objectivity as rank partisans. It has enticed once serious people into crowd-pleasing clownishness. It has made politicians dumber and cruder. It has distorted political reality for people across the spectrum. It, in short, has helped derange our politics, with the former tweeter-in-chief leading the way. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, January 13th. Barbara Joan Caffey. Barbara Joan Caffey passed away peacefully at the age of 97 in Dallas after her battle with COVID-19. Barbara was born in Fort Worth on January 3rd, 1924, to parents Louis George and Marie Bundock, who immigrated from England after World War I. She is survived by her daughter, Jan Worthington, Kevin, grandchildren Emily Gossett, Audrey Miles, Jason, and Ashley Worthington, and great-grandchildren Jake Gossett, Adeline Miles, and Avery Miles. She is also survived by numerous nieces and nephews. Barbara was preceded in death by her children, Joan and Kyle, and her husband, Cliff. She will be interred in Midland with her husband, Cliff. No funeral service will occur at this time. A private graveside ceremony is expected to be held later in 2021. In lieu of flowers, donations in her memory can be made to Feeding America. www.feedingamerica.org. Charles Davis Ray. Charles Davis Ray, Charlie, passed away peacefully at home on January 3rd, 2021, after a battle with cancer. Charlie was born in Corsicana, Texas, on February 8, 1943, to Marguerite Maggard and Charles Garvis Ray. Charlie is preceded in death by his parents. He is survived by his wife of 41 years, Lynn Stoltenberg Ray, of Midland, his sister, Kathy Ray Davenport, of Fort Worth, his daughter, Anna Margaret Ray Morris, of Austin, his stepchildren, Debbie Sportmore, Sean, of Midland, Sherry Sport of New Orleans, Louisiana, and Rosh Sport, Tasha Finley Sport of Midland. 11 grandchildren, 2 nieces and nephews, his in-laws Richard and Sue Ann Campbell of Midland, and other relatives, loved ones, and friends. In light of the current COVID situation, an intimate family memorial service and burial will take place pending arrangements with the Ellis Funeral Home. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be given to Hospice of Midland, MD Anderson, or the charity of your choice. Josephine Hines. Graveside service for Joe Hines, 94, of Seminole, will be held at 1 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, Wednesday, January 13th, at the Portales Cemetery in Portales, New Mexico, under the direction of Ratliff Funeral Home of Seminole. Visitation for family and friends will be Tuesday, from 1 to 8 p.m. We ask you to follow COVID guidelines. Our precious mom, Jo Hines, passed away Friday, January 8th in Midland. She was born August 11, 1926, to Beulah Burns and Maurice Toombs in Littlefield, Texas. When Jo was in the fifth grade, Wayne Hines picked her out to be his wife. They married on January 23, 1945, in Maple, Texas, and were married for 58 years until Wayne passed in 2003. They had 3 daughters and sons-in-law, Diana and Johnny Fayo, Joanne and Harry Staley, and Lynn and Fred Gilliland. Mamie loved her 7 grandchildren and many great and great-great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers and memorials may be sent to Ronald McDonald House, the Leukemia Society, or charity of your choice. Maria Guadalupe Camarillo. Maria Guadalupe Camarillo, 63, of Zamora, Michoacan, Mexico, passed away on January 8th. Viewing will be from 3 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, January 13th. At Nellie Picklin-Wells Funeral Home. Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday, January 14th at Nellie Picklin-Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Friday, January 15th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Maria Guadalupe Camarillo was born on November 28, 1957, in Zamora, Michoacán, Mexico, to Francisco Camarillo Hernandez and Maria Oseguera Moreno. She moved to Midland, Texas in 1986, where she raised two daughters, Sandra Haro Nunez and Joy Camarillo Bustamante. She worked at Luby's for 14 years and then worked at Midland Memorial Hospital for 14 years. She is survived by her brother, Jesus Camarillo Oseguera, her two daughters, Sandra Haro Nunez, Joy Camarillo Bustamante, seven grandchildren and one great-grandchild, and two sons-in-law, Melba Nunez and John N. Bustamante. Maria is preceded in death by both her parents and her sister, Carmen Camarillo Oseguera. The family would like to express their gratitude toward the staff of hospice and staff at Midland Memorial. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Hospice Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Raymond Lee Straub, January 26, 1932 to January 11, 2021. Raymond Lee Straub, the paterfamilias to the West Texas Straub family, a third-generation lifelong resident of Stanton, Texas, passed away after fighting a short illness just 15 days before his 89th birthday on Monday, January 11th. He peacefully slipped his earthly bonds to join the Lord and his sons, Charles Lee Straub, Baby Straub, and Martin Ray Straub, at his home, surrounded by his family, whom he loved. Raymond was born on January 26, 1932, in Stanton, Texas, to the Alsatian Catholic family of Albert Charles Straub and Beatrice Ursula Riding Straub. Raymond married Wanda Jean Anderson of Odessa on October 27, 1959. Raymond and Wanda had four children, Charles Lee, Baby Straub, Martin Ray, and Raymond Lee Jr. Charles Lee died in an auto accident in 1986. Baby Straub died at birth. Martin Ray died at home in Stanton in 2020, and Raymond Lee Straub Jr. still resides in Stanton. Raymond is survived by his wife, Wanda Jean Straub of Stanton, whom he often called his beautiful wife and the mother of his children. He is also survived by his youngest son, Raymond Lee Straub Jr., daughter-in-law Lana McGee Straub, and grandson Raymond Lee Straub III of Stanton. Additional survivors include Martin's widow, Kayla Jo Straub, and his grandsons Christopher Charles Straub and Tyler Ray Straub, as well as Charles's widow, Colonel Tyra Swanson. The family will receive gift friends at Gilbraith Funeral Home on Wednesday, January 13th at 7 p.m. for a rosary. On Thursday, January 14th, an indoor service will be family-only and held at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Stanton. A graveside service will follow at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery, where friends may gather for his final journey home. Face coverings are required for attendance at all services. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Martin County Senior Citizen Center. The family would like to express their gratitude toward hospice, the hospital staff at Midland Memorial Hospital and Martin County Hospital, especially Megan Chandler. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbraith Funeral Home of Stanton. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Verna Mae Rainey Caldwell. Verna Mae Rainey Caldwell went to be with the Lord Saturday morning, January 2nd, 2021. Her life covered 98 remarkable years. Verna Mae was born July 17, 1922, on a farm between Texola, Texas, and Erick, Oklahoma. She was born to Vernie Camelia and Carl Grady Rainey, and was preceded in death by her five siblings and by her beloved husband of 67 years, James Henry Caldwell. Verna Mae is survived by her two daughters, Sandra Sivage and husband Vernon of Pleasanton, Texas, and Lana Stahl and husband John of Katy, Texas, five grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. Verna May spent her last years in Houston and eventually Pleasanton, Texas, to be nearer her daughters. Services will be at Hurley Funeral Home in Pleasanton on Saturday, January 9th, presided by her son-in-law, Dr. Vernon Sivich. Burial will be at Serenity Memorial Gardens in Midland on Monday, January 11th. Death notices. Jesus M. Villafranco. Jesus M. Villafranco, age 68, passed away Sunday, January 10th. He leaves to cherish his memories his wife Juana Villafranco, sons Jesse Villafranco, Miguel Villafranco, Juan Lara, Mario Lara, two sisters, and two brothers. Memorial service will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Margie Cheney Swift. Margie Cheney Swift, 82, of Midland, passed from this life on January 8, 2021, in Odessa. She was born to the late William and Lila Bariner on September 26, 1938, in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. She is survived by her husband, Roger Swift, children Merle, Rick Cheney, and Pat Raglan, and one sibling, three grandchildren, and five great-grandchildren.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, January 13th. Odessans left in dark on COVID rates. County official says vaccines, not numbers, top priority. By Federico Martinez. Ector County will no longer share local COVID-19 data with the public because county officials claim they don't have the resources to keep the public informed. County Health Authority Dr. Babatunde Janadu said Tuesday. Janadu made his comments as other local health officials noted during Tuesday's virtual press conference that COVID-19 cases have spiked again this week to alarmingly high rates, which could prompt the state to impose a new round of restrictions in Ector County. Janadu defended the county's decision by pointing out that the county health department has had to reduce its staff from 15 to 6 people as of December 29th due to lack of funding. It's just a matter of time and resources, and we just don't have the resources, Janadu said. Up to December 29th, we had the resources and we were able to stay updated. However, local media pointed out before and after the news conference that the county was frequently the target of public criticism throughout 2020 for its inconsistency in releasing local COVID data. Often the county failed to update their website for several weeks, even with a larger staff. This past fall, the county donated more than $700,000 in CARES funds earmarked for COVID to various local nonprofit organizations. As of press time Tuesday, it was unclear why that funding wasn't saved to continue paying contact tracers and workers to update daily numbers. Janadu said the county is required to report local COVID numbers to the state once per week, but the state has also been inconsistent in updating its information. The state's COVID-19 information website as of Tuesday hadn't been updated since December 29th. Janadu said keeping the public informed isn't the county's current top priority. The top priority is getting people vaccinated. The numbers are a priority to the extent that we can get the resources to manage and input the numbers, Janadu said. The Texas Department of State Health Services announced this week that Ector and Midland counties would not be receiving any new vaccine shipments this week. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH and Odessa Regional Medical Center officials are working together to see how they can establish Ector and Midland counties as a hub. The current nearest hub is in Lubbock. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Rohith Saravanan said COVID cases locally have been increasing this week, which he attributed to a post-Christmas holiday spike. Saravanan on Tuesday cautioned that on Sunday and Monday, coronavirus patients were again accounting for more than 15% of hospital beds in Ector County. The state considers anything over the 15% threshold as cause for alarm and if that number remains over 15% for 7 consecutive days, can prompt state-imposed sanctions, such as limiting business occupancy rates or mandating that all residents and employees must wear masks inside businesses. On Sunday, the county's hospital bed rate was 16.22% and 15.6% on Monday before dipping to 12.6% on Tuesday, Sarah Vannon said. Sunday was the first time since November that the county had topped 15%, Sarah Vannon said. In November, former Mayor David Turner and council passed an ordinance that limited business capacity to 50%, which also included a face covering mandate. After 4 weeks, rates shrunk to just under 15%, which prompted council to cancel the 50% capacity, but kept the face covering mandate in effect. On Tuesday, MCH reported 78 COVID patients at the hospital, with 22 in critical care and 13 on ventilators. ORMC reported 26 COVID patients, 16 in critical care and 3 on ventilators. County's 2021 road work detailed. West 42nd widening to be extended. Ector County Commissioners Tuesday accepted Public Works Director Evans Kessie's 2020 Roads and Streets Construction Report and heard his 2021 plan to spend $5.2 million widening, upgrading, and improving drainage on West 42nd Street from Farm to Market 1936 to Moss Avenue. Other work on the Highways and Streets Department's schedule this year includes the $7.2 million widening and rehabilitation of 8.2 miles of Cottonwood Road from U.S. 385 to the Midland County line, the $1.4 million widening and upgrading of 4 miles of Apple Street from 385 to Jasper Avenue, and the $789,000 widening and rehabilitation of a mile of West 87th Street from 385 to North County Road West. Kessie said that among work accomplished during the past year, financed largely by the 1.25-cent sales tax that was authorized by the voters in 2018, was the $5 million widening and upgrading of West 42nd from the Kermit Highway to West Loop 338. Saying that his crews had worked throughout the year in the trying circumstances of the pandemic, he said, "I'm proud for my employees." In their bimonthly review of COVID-19-related concerns, the commissioners agreed that a mass vaccination should be organized as soon as enough vaccine is received, either from the Pfizer or Moderna pharmaceutical companies, which are the medicine's principal manufacturers. Noting that Medical Center Hospital, Odessa Regional Medical Center, and the County Health Department had injected a few thousand people in recent weeks as the vaccines trickled in, Precinct 1 Commissioner Mike Gardner said, "The hospitals have done a stand-up job, but they are in kind of cramped-up spaces. We need to find places where we can do it more efficiently, and people will have a place to wait for a little bit and see if they are going to have a reaction," the commissioner said. In other business, in the 10 a.m. meeting, the court heard Building Maintenance Director Charles Pierce's appeal for overtime pay to be made permanent for all county employees and voted unanimously for overtime henceforth to be paid to the Health, Information Technology, Cemetery, and Building Maintenance Departments. Answering a question from Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons, Auditor Randy Donner had said he was unsure how overtime for all employees could be paid for now that the 2021 budget has gone into effect. The county's general existing system is for compensatory time to be taken for overtime work.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.